Hello, everybody. My name is Brian Quinn. I'm an attorney, and I'm here today to present a CLE for you entitled Coronavirus and Your Mental Health, A Lawyer's Guide to Coping with Isolation, Anxiety, and Fear in Uncertain Times. I'm a Pennsylvania lawyer. I'm here actually on behalf of Lawyers Concerned for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, which is Pennsylvania's Lawyers Assistance Program. We do education and training programs like these as part of our services to attorneys and their family members because we feel that these programs that deal with substance use issues and mental health issues are as important as anything that we do. This is how we help to alleviate the fear, the misunderstanding, and the stigma that surrounds alcoholism, drug abuse, and mental health disorders. We feel that what you don't know about those subjects will hurt you and our profession. So I'm going to gear this program today around impairment issues in general, but more specific, how the recent coronavirus pandemic has impacted lawyers, especially with respect to these types of mental health and substance use issues. So in order to put this in perspective, I'd like to start with some surveys and some information regarding what types of issues lawyers have been facing before COVID-19. My reason for doing that is that you will soon see the fact that lawyers are already and have always been for many, many years in a high-risk category. So let me start by discussing what was the first survey of lawyers in the United States conducted in 2015, and it was the first that had been conducted of any type for 25 years. So the ABA, the American Bar Association, and the Hazel and Betty Ford Foundation teamed up, and they retained a gentleman named Patrick Krill, K-R-I-L-L. Krill is a lawyer and certified drug and alcohol counselor, and he conducted a study of that involved nearly 13,000 licensed lawyers covering 19 states in the United States. The qualifications were they had to be licensed and employed in some capacity in the legal profession. So you had private practicing lawyers, you had in-house corporate lawyers, you had governmental lawyers, you had judicial law clerks, people like that. So it covered a lot of areas. And Krill found, by asking anonymous and confidential questionnaires, his findings were, in his own words, they were incompatible with a sustainable professional culture. So I'm not going to speak much about alcohol use, but I want you to remember that one of the ways lawyers cope with items, issues like stress and anxiety and depression is to drink. So let's look at what the pre-COVID-19 prevalence rates were. Krill found that 21% of all licensed attorneys suffer from problematic drinking, which is defined as hazardous or possible dependent drinking, not just having one too many or once or twice too often. With that rate rising to nearly one-third of all attorneys under the age of 30. So that is pre-COVID. He also did a survey involving the use of drugs among lawyers. And frankly, only 3,400 lawyers of the nearly 13,000 bothered to answer those questions. So Krill could not even compile any meaningful statistics. The caveat with all of these studies, by the way, is that most people, and especially lawyers, will underreport their drug and alcohol use, and they will be somewhat reluctant they're not really capable of self-diagnosing all mental health issues. I want to put that out there. So Krill felt that whatever numbers he did come up with are probably low. Keep in mind, this is 2015. This was a study that was published in February of 2016 in the Journal of Addiction Medicine. With respect to mental health issues, as of that study, Phil found that 28% of all attorneys suffer from major depressive disorder. That's not just being sad or unhappy on occasion. These are individuals who would qualify under the DSM statistical manual for major depressive disorder. 28% of all attorneys. Likewise, DSM qualified, 23% of all attorneys suffer from stress, and 19% suffered from anxiety, with, yes, even higher rates than those among younger lawyers. Once again, 2015 survey was taken, 2016 it was published. Then a more recent survey, bringing it a little bit closer, but still pre-COVID, was conducted by ALM Intelligence and Law.com. Their mental health and substance abuse survey found that there was an overwhelming majority of legal professionals that believed that their mental well-being was worse off as a result of their chosen career. But let's look at some of those numbers. By the way, this survey indicates, really sheds some light on life inside of a law office or a law firm. And it shows how firm mental health programs are viewed and the causes of mental health challenges in a law firm setting. Once again, with the caveat that these are probably numbers that are underreported. And I say that because when you see them on this next slide, mental health by the numbers. First of all, that 74% feel the profession has had a negative impact on their mental health. 64% feel they suffer from anxiety. 31% feel they're depressed. 44% use alcohol to deal with stress. And most important on this one, 18% of the lawyers surveyed have contemplated suicide at some point in their careers. Now, Krill, the gentleman who performed the 2015 study, felt that that was a rather frightening piece of information because it's more than twice the suicidal ideation of adults throughout their lifetimes. The lawyers are disproportionately more likely to contemplate suicide than non-lawyers are. 65% felt they could not take an extended leave from employment to tend to their mental health issues. 62% know a colleague who's depressed. Over half know a colleague with an alcohol problem. There seems to be some reluctance to discuss their mental health issues at work. Many felt that a leave of absence or discussion of that type would hurt their career trajectory. So, these are issues that really are quite compelling. One of the things that lawyers said that they felt impacted them the most was their inability to disconnect, that they felt that they were always on call. And now, once again, that puts it something to some of these in perspective. This is all before COVID-19's impact on our profession. One of the statistics, one of the issues that is really high on the list among many lawyers is depression. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on any of these particular disorders until we get really to the COVID-19 issues. But I want to raise your awareness level. I'm a lawyer, not a clinician. So I want to put that out there right now. I am not suggesting that this is a clinical study of depression or anxiety or stress, but I do think that you have to have some idea of what those words mean, especially with respect to how they impair lawyers. So what causes depression? One of the things that, first of all, depression, in order to qualify for a major depressive disorder, you have to have been experiencing your symptoms almost every day for at least 2 weeks, and they have to be more intense than the normal fluctuations in mood that all of us experience in our daily lives. So it's not enough to just experience one of the symptoms over this two-week period. You have to have at least five of them to qualify, and one of these five has to be either a depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure in activities. So it has many different causes, And there's a slide, what causes depression? And right in the center of that slide, you'll see it says stressful life events. Well, if COVID-19 isn't a stressful life event, then I'm not sure what could be termed a stressful life event. One of the issues that we are seeing is the connection between trauma and depression, trauma and impairment among lawyers. Usually I speak about vicarious trauma, the trauma that we experience secondhand based upon the type of work that we do day in and day out, that it can start to weigh upon us. And we actually, if we have clients who were traumatized, we can start to take that home with us when we leave the office. But we are expecting that this COVID-19 will be, without any question, a generational traumatic event. And as a result, we do anticipate that there is going to be post-traumatic stress disorder in the lives of many people. And I'll get to that in a few more minutes. Stressful life events. Symptoms of depression. I've already mentioned that you need more than just one of them. But I want to point out on the second slide of symptoms down at the bottom, social or occupational distress or isolation. Social distress, social isolation. Sound familiar? Occupational distress, occupational isolation. Sound familiar too under the present state that we find ourselves in during this COVID-19 crisis. We didn't really think too much about what those words meant until now. They're not only being seen in some people, but all of us have now had isolation imposed upon us. You know, I don't know what everyone's practice area is that listens to this presentation. There may be many out there that are solo practitioners or in small firms. You know, we're the solo practitioner, and I was a solo practitioner for over 40 years, is used to working alone, okay? But now, no matter how large your firm is, you may not be a sole practitioner, but you are a solitary practitioner. You are isolated. And I'm going to talk about just what that does to people very soon. So I mentioned depression, but I want to move on to something else, which has really been overtaking depression as the number one area of mental health disorder in our profession. As a matter of fact, even when Krill did his study back in 2015, among female lawyers, stress and anxiety were had far greater prevalence rates than depression. Male attorneys seem to put depression first, whereas females had anxiety and stress. So what is stress? Psychological stress is composed of the following sequence of elements: a stimulus, thought, emotion, and a behavior. Our mental response to stress reflects how we first perceive and then subsequently think about any given situation. Our brains are constantly evaluating our present circumstances and defining it as rewarding, risky, threatening, or unknown. So our initial response operates on a subconscious level and influences our emotional and physical responses. This subconscious and spontaneous analysis of every situation we encounter is really a vital part of our instinctive survival mechanism. Think in terms of the animal kingdom's freeze, fight, or flight response. So our brains are sending out these signals to the rest of our body and triggering specific chemical reactions as well as other specific physical and emotional responses. So sometimes this subconscious process propels us to take immediate action in an emergency, get out of harm's way. It may trigger a fear-based response, causing us to strike out in defense. We can, however, exert conscious control over our thoughts and our emotions to put the brakes on impulsive, harmful, or inappropriate emotions and behavior. We can learn to hit the pause button to thoughtfully respond rather than to instinctively react. So, do you stay calm and unruffled? looking for solutions. Alternatively, you get angry, look for someone to blame. Some people are stress hardy and don't seem affected by the pressures and problems of daily living. I don't think there's many of us out there right now under the current circumstances with the coronavirus pandemic that haven't had some impact. You can be as stress hardy as you want. But they seem to thrive on challenges, some people. But others are unable to withstand any pressure or difficulty without being upset or rendered unable to act. Most of us fall somewhere in between. As I said, the stress reaction is the result of a complex interaction of memories, emotions, thoughts, automatic responses, physiological responses. They are impacted by your personal genetics, your childhood experiences. Our initial emotional response to acute stress may be one of joyful anticipation, or it can be fear and anxiety. Thoughtful, optimistic, and calm emotional responses reduce harmful stress, whereas resentment, anxiety, and anger generate harmful stress. Our individual responses may differ from one another because of our individual differences. Otherwise, everyone would react in the same manner to a situation. So depending on our individual personal health, finances, personal relationships, whether or not we've ever had a similar experience of this type in the past, and I dare say no one has ever experienced anything like we're going through with COVID-19 right now. So our individual responses to the same situation may also vary depending on how we're feeling at that particular time. You know, some days we deal with a particular stressor well, some days we deal with poorly with the same exact stressor. So first time experience that we're dealing with makes it much more difficult, because normally if we've had a prior similar experience and the outcome was positive, it's less likely to cause us stress. If it was negative, it's more likely to cause us stress in the future. Were we caught off guard? We certainly were caught off guard by this. So all these factors affect how we perceive and react to our present circumstances. So let's ask ourselves a few questions about stress in our lives. How stressed are you? Do you feel overly responsible for everything and everybody? Do you overanalyze things and feel that you're too cautious? Does it make you feel depressed, defeated, or hopeless? Do you often rely on alcohol or drugs to help you feel good? Do you ever think about quitting? Or do you think about it quite a bit? These are some of the things that we ask ourselves. You know, too many events. You know, some stress is healthy. I go back sometimes and chuckle when I think of the base question that Patrick Krill asked all the lawyers. His question was, since the day you became an attorney until the very moment that you're filling out this questionnaire, have you ever attributed anything in your career to either depression, stress, or anxiety? And 67% of the lawyers said yes. Personally, I say the other 33% lied. But that's not a scientific conclusion. It's Brian Quinn's conclusion, so you can't cite me as an authority on that. It's just my own personal life experience as a lawyer. You know, a totally stress-free life is not only unrealistic, it can actually be a harmful form of denial. But as I said, some stress is healthy. Positive stressors can energize and motivate a lawyer to be productive and creative problem solvers. However, too many events, changes, or demands in our lives, even positive ones, can leave us feeling overwhelmed and sometimes paralyzed with worry about how we will get it all done. When life seems too much for us to handle, stress has ceased to be that ally, that positive impact on us with energy and motivation. It ceases to be our ally and now becomes our foe. We have now entered into a life of distress. Distress. And warning, folks, we can be in distress and not even know it. We need to eliminate distress in our lives, because distress is harmful both physically and psychologically. Gradual, incremental increases in our responsibilities, duties, pressures, and demands at home and at work. And certainly our home life is being impacted by COVID-19. So now it's a whole new ball game. But if we're working from home and living at home, and our families are with us all the time, kids are home from school. If you have kids, if you have a significant other, a spouse, whatever, you're not used to that. So these responsibilities and duties and pressures are shifting. At some point, work can dominate our lives and keep us at a chronically high level of distress, just as lawyers. Sometimes we become unaware we've even lost balance in our lives. You know, work-life balance. Work-life is two words. Work-life balance. But many of us don't pause between those words. It's work-life. Work-life. That's what the lawyers look. Our life is our work. Our work is our life. We stay busy and stuff our feelings, many of us. We're so busy that we don't take time to learn how to deal with those negative stressors in our life. So that when we don't have work to do, perhaps we've lost much or all of our business during the COVID-19 crisis, we don't know how to deal with these other stressors because our go-to, our hard wire has always been, oh, got to be something to do at work. I'll work. I'll worry about that stuff later. I've got work to do. Workaholism is a real problem among many attorneys. So, as I said, you become unaware that you've lost balance in your life. So, with no busy schedule in front of us, these feelings come back and cause us discomfort because our solution has always been to get busy, but we don't have that. So, the person who has been relying on work and as a way of escaping, relaxing can cause us to feel distress. And remember that distressed lawyers eventually lose their efficiency and their effectiveness. So look at some of these stress busters. They're tried and true. There's a couple of slides on quick stress busters. I dare say that you will find some of them to be rather commonsensical. There's no magic.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is HIP, H-I-P, all lowercase, HIP. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is HIP, H-I-P, all lowercase, HIP. Please take a moment and write this down.
To many of them. I just think that they bear reviewing, and if I don't get a chance, I'm not really going to go over all of those right now, but some of them, let's take a look at. And sometimes it can be as simple as pausing and leaning back and resting for a few minutes, taking a few deep breaths. There are so many mindfulness and meditation apps on our phones now for 3-minute meditation, 5-minute meditation, 10-minute meditation, whatever amount of time you want. You know, try to relax a little bit and be in the immediate present. Stretch a little bit, walk around, depending on your home situation. I'm in Pennsylvania. We are 100% in mandatory shut-in. And I was just discussing before the presentation began, it looks like it's going to go on for, because I'm in suburban Philadelphia. And it's unlikely that that's going to stop anytime soon. Those of you who are listening in other areas of the country may find it a little more easy to go out and relax and stretch and walk around, get a little exercise. But if you don't, find some way to do it where you are inside. Try to maintain a little bit of a sense of humor and vary your routine. One of the most tried and true ways to alleviate stress for lawyers is to learn how to manage our time more effectively. Stress management for lawyers involves, for the most part, many things, but one of them, at the top of the list, is always time management. Prioritizing our work and our home duties and responsibilities and try to manage them effectively, prioritize things. And last but not least on that slide is ask for help. Talk about these things with someone that you trust. Eat healthy, exercise, as I said. Cultivate a positive attitude. Try to get a good night's sleep. You're going to hear a lot about sleep. The impact of on sleep disrupts sleep. Sleep disorders are one of the signs of depression, either too much sleep or too little sleep. Anxiety impacts sleep. Fear impacts sleep. So when possible, try to get a good night's sleep, 8 hours if you can. Hopefully, with the change in our schedules right now, that may be a little bit more doable. Certainly try to unplug from social media when acutely distressed. Try meditation. Consistent stress reduction occurs with only 10 minutes of daily meditation. And whatever you do, try to avoid the overuse of alcohol and prescription drugs, because these are nothing more than short-term fixes that mask the problem. They mask the problem and can lead to those negative health and social consequences. So what's COVID? What do you think about when you think of this COVID-19 situation? Because as I've said, and as I've shown you, lawyers are already in a high risk. Now we're facing something both new and unforeseen as the result of COVID-19. The first of which is aloneness. There are two states of aloneness: the physical state of being alone, which is solitude, and the emotional state of being alone, which is loneliness. Solitude is not always painful. In fact, it can be quite pleasant for those who are comfortable and confident with themselves and who understand that it need not be a permanent experience. A stable balance between solitude and time with others is necessary for mental and physical well-being. Even when we are forced to be alone, knowing that someone is with us in spirit helps. So developing that I'm not alone mentality is truly vital. Conversely, loneliness is the emotional state of being alone. It's the belief that no one else understands our circumstances, our thoughts, or our emotions, nor do they care. Social isolation. Now, there's a term that we didn't even think about until COVID-19. Social distancing, social isolation. Remember one of the symptoms of depression: social and occupational distress. Already talked about that. And isolation. Social isolation is the combination of solitude and loneliness experienced by an individual for an extended period. Both the emotional and physical state feed off of one another and can create an inability to re-engage with society in a meaningful way. Oh, social distancing. Social distancing. You know, it used to be isolation is no longer just perceived. But now it's immediate and ongoing. Social distancing comes with its own risks. Humans are social animals. We're hardwired for connection. Remember that isolation can also be one of the primary ways that lawyers use to hide or avoid discussing what's really going on in their lives. Hopefully I'll get to that, the slides about some of the common warning signs, and these are common warning signs that have always existed among lawyers. And I do presentations like these, and I've been doing them for 3 years now. I've done hundreds of them. And at the top of the list of common warning signs is, and has always been, isolation. Lawyers love to isolate and not talk about what's going on in their lives for a variety of reasons. Now, hey, it's being imposed on me. I have to isolate. And they're happy to a degree, to a point, because now they don't have to give an excuse for why they're not more available, why they're avoiding interactions. Well, I'm social distancing. So make it a priority to stay in touch with friends and family. Okay, lawyers are, as I said, already at greater risk to resort to negative behavior to make things, quote unquote, better. That's why it's important to stay connected as best we can and reach out for support when we need it, even as we eliminate in-person socializing. Take advantage of the technology, the face-to-face ability, Zoom meetings, FaceTime, things like that. Face-to-face contact is like a vitamin for your mental health. Think of it that way. It reduces your risk of depression, helps ease stress and anxiety. So if you know someone else who's struggling, reach out to them or call your lawyer's assistance program. By the way, there's a directory of lawyer's assistance programs at the end of this slide, along with literally, I think, 6 or 7 slides full of resources, most of which have to deal with issues surrounding the COVID-19 crisis. Okay? Check what your state offers. There is some form of lawyer's assistance in every state in the United States. Some of them are independent, like they are here in Pennsylvania, Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania. Some are a spinoff of a lawyer wellness committee or something along those lines of a state bar association. But if you have any questions and you're not certain about what's going on in your state, call the numbers that are on this presentation for Lawyers Concern for Lawyers of Pennsylvania, and we will direct you. We often get calls following these national CLE presentations that we do from lawyers in other areas of the country, and we will direct you accordingly. Getting back to this isolation, social media can be a powerful tool, not only for connecting with friends, family, and acquaintances, but for feeling connected in a greater sense to our communities. But we have to be very careful of overdosing on it. Be mindful of how social media is making you feel. If it's exacerbating your anxiety, log off if it's making you feel worse. And try not to let coronavirus dominate every conversation that you have with someone nowadays. We know it's difficult. These are extraordinarily trying times. All those tried and true stress management strategies apply. Eating healthy, getting plenty of sleep, meditating. Be kind to yourself. Go easy on yourself if you're experiencing more depression or anxiety than usual because of this crisis. You're not alone in your struggles. Remember that regular practice delivers the greatest benefits. So all those stress busters, you got to do them not just once a week. Try to do them every day. Okay? See if you can set aside a little time every day to do them. And by the way, another thing that's been shown to work for lawyers, and for everyone for that matter, write a gratitude list every day. The things you're grateful for. It'll give you a chance to use black ink, not just red ink. Help others. It's easy to get caught up on our own fears and concerns amid all the stories of people fighting over rolls of toilet paper or lining up outside gun stores to arm themselves. It's important to take a breath. Remember that we're all in this together. Be a calming influence on your family, on your clients. They're scared too. Be kind to others. Okay? So, once again, we all know that coronavirus seems to be dominating our conversations. We've been told we were told a couple of weeks ago to prepare for something in the nature of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor all wrapped into one. I dare say that there are some people who think that may be looking at it too provincially, that this is a worldwide, generational, traumatic event. So what does this mean for us, for lawyers? What about us, people like many of us who are already trying to deal with stress and anxiety in our daily lives? Let's look at anxiety and figure out maybe there are some tips for dealing with it. So first, let's talk about what it is. It's a feeling of worry, nervousness, or unease, typically about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome. Uncertain outcome? Sounds familiar as well. There's a variety of symptoms that characterize anxiety disorders. Many of them are, once there's that restlessness and fatigue, difficulty concentrating, agitation and irritability, excessive worrying that disrupts our daily functioning. There are many types of anxiety disorders. Once again, this is not a clinical discussion. I don't have time to go over what each of these mean. If any of them sound familiar or you're interested in them, there is resource material at the conclusion of this program and on the last few slides that you can look into it more carefully. We're already in this group that's experiencing rates of depression, stress, and anxiety, and alcohol use, and substance use disorders that far exceed the rest of the population. Now, it's too early in this coronavirus pandemic to know the exact extent to which anxiety disorders are on the rise, because most of the clinical cases really have been lost in the din of the global panic. But anecdotally, doctors seem to be reporting both new anxieties among existing patients and relapses among former patients. Now, generalized anxiety disorder is a pathological response to everyday challenges like worries over money, work, deadlines, parenting. For people with GAD, those common woes produce really a disabling pain. And we know that coronavirus is going to have an impact on them because now the worry becomes, how do I pay my bills? What if I lose my job? What if I lose my car? Think about it this way. Anxiety disorders are based on two words. What if, followed by the worst scenario your brain can devise. As I mentioned earlier, we expect a lot of post-traumatic stress disorder going forward for quite some time. PTSD patients live with a sort of chronic angst and anxiety. But one more mortal threat like COVID-19 can really be more than they can bear. And of course, social distancing denies PTSD patients one of their most effective therapeutic strategies, which is company. So detachment from family, friends, and other relationships, and previously pleasurable activities are all hallmarks of PTSD. So the person with PTSD can't have that person knocking on their door to check on them and have those relationships. So the detachment for those people is exacerbating it for sure. Of course, the ones who are probably affected the most are the ones with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. That disorder, by definition, entails anxiety about germs, disease, and social interaction. So it's that much harder to manage when the world tells you that, guess what, now is the time to feel that fear for real. So how do we calm these anxieties while we're feeling uncertain, helpless, scared, unsure, paralyzed? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? While anxiety makes entry into the future a thing to be dreaded, it also can eradicate any memory of the bounty of the present. We can make it our goal to move through this day, even if we have to do it like many people in a 12-step program, a day at a time. You may have heard that expression. Sometimes it has to be an hour at a time, a moment at a time. We can use that to our advantage to cross off tasks that you complete as you go. When we operate in a state of anxiety, even doing tasks or accomplishing endeavors doesn't release that same good feeling in our body that it usually does. We feel it no different than when we started. It makes the relevance of everything questionable. So if you start to feel that way, you've got to start, the antenna has to go up. You have to start thinking about how you can deal with anxiety. Because sometimes we're going to feel it more stronger than others. Hey, let's face it, we're jumpy. We're scared. We may be asking ourselves, since when am I scared on a random, whatever day it is that you're listening to this, in April, May, whenever? And yet we find ourselves afraid. We start to resort to the what ifs, becoming afraid the anxiety will never leave us, afraid we will never regain the form we felt just a few short weeks ago. So, what are some of the tips that we have for dealing with COVID-19 anxiety? Well, one of the things, again, anxiety will lead to a range of sleep problems. So that's why we implore you to maintain a consistent bedtime, limit your caffeine and alcohol intake. Try to stay off screens and practice mindfulness. Try to spend at least one device-free hour before bed. No phone, no TV, nothing, no device or screen for an hour before bed. You find that people are having difficulty focusing as the result of anxiety. One of the things, as I mentioned, is time management. That helps to improve our concentration, and because it reduces both stress and anxiety. So when you feel yourself struggling with an urge to check the news while you're doing something else, I wonder what's going on. Wonder what's happening with the latest death toll, or what's going on in my area. When will I be able to open my office again and go back to work? Are the kids going to have any school this year? When you feel that urge to check the news right in the middle of whatever work you're doing, or any other activity, try to delay on acting on that urge. Notice how it lessens with time. That is referred to as surfing the urge. That's the process that we suggest. If 10 minutes is too long, start with 2 minutes. Okay, as I said, try to do whatever you have to do so that you can sit with the urge without acting on it. The longer you can do it, the better you'll be at staying focused on your task. Forgetfulness, increased irritability and anger are other things that we're seeing as signs of this of anxiety during these times. Why lawyers? Now, are you someone who rarely, if ever, calls friends just to catch up? You prefer texting to spontaneous small talk? On this day and age, you might want to rethink things, especially with the pandemic. Getting out of your own head, thinking about other people's concerns rather than focusing on your own is a strategy to stay focused, to stay well. Thinking about other people can include a spontaneous phone call. When you get on the phone, you know, lawyers don't like to do that. It causes discomfort for some lawyers. We don't know how long people are going to talk, what they're going to say. We're not used to reacting in real time. We don't have control over the conversation. And we love control. Lawyers created layers. We create layers and layers of insulation. And that's not really how people thrive. So another way to manage coronavirus-related fears is to write them down. Use your analytical brain to think about what's the actual likelihood of these things occurring. And what can you do to mitigate or prepare for these things you are actually worried about? Let's talk about some more tips on dealing with fear. In light of the various coronavirus restrictions, many of which are announced or re-announced almost daily, attorneys worry about what comes next. In many ways, that's our job as lawyers, to be thinking about the unknown. It's a really easy mindset for lawyers to find themselves in and overindulge in. We're good at that. So this is really a good time for anyone to step back and cultivate a little bit of optimism in themselves. But let's look at some of those tips as well. Staying away from social media, I already mentioned that, and up-to-the-minute news. Know the facts. Know what some of these things that they're referring to mean. The difference between how widespread a disease is, which is really what a pandemic means, it refers to, as opposed to the deadliness of an illness. Actively remind yourself of reasons not to worry. That's the gratitude list that I already mentioned. Creating new routines. Call people if you live alone. Isolation is already a warning sign for the lawyers. Stay connected. Seek help. Reach out. Call a medical professional or call your lawyer's assistance program. Your lawyer's assistance program. That's why we're there. Lawyers love to be in control. Try to focus on things you really can control. Everybody says we have control issues. We're control freaks. As long as we're focusing on questions with unknowable answers and circumstances outside of our personal control, this strategy will get us nowhere other than drained, anxious, and overwhelmed. It's going to get us absolutely nowhere. It will actually be detrimental. We got to learn to keep the what ifs under control. Remember, that's the key of to anxiety. What if?
Esquire CLE's second verification code is OIL. O-I-L. All lowercase. OIL. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is OIL. O-I-L. All lowercase. OIL. Please take a moment and write this down.
Followed by the worst scenario your brain can imagine. One of the ways we suggest to do it is to practice mindfulness. Some people say, that's not for me. Try it. Give it a try. Then decide whether or not it's for you. Don't be turned off by the word itself. Okay? The word itself. Because it actually can focus our attention. And mostly on the positive things that we have, the positive things that we have going on in our lives. It's not all negative. Remember, use black ink, not red ink, when we're thinking about all those good things. Bring our mind back to our bodies and breathe until we're calm. There are other issues and challenges to working from home. Depending on the type of practice, I have a couple of slides here with some suggestions. First of all, set yourself up for success. If you don't have a website, get one. If you have one, improve it. Mention the virus and your status on your by putting a banner on it. Make it clear that if your office is closed, you're still working, and that you're there for your clients. People can still call, email, video with you. We're scared. We don't have any business to go back to when we return. Some people are already thinking about what their clients might need right now, wills, powers of attorney, healthcare directives, and what they might need later. Yes, if you have a practice that involves clients whose businesses are decimated, I'm thinking of people who represent a lot of restaurants or people in those industries that have been shut in, some people are taking advantage of a new area of practice. There's continuing legal education. This company has numerous continuing legal education seminars. So use that. Take the time that you have and use it to advantage. But remember that you need to be confident to practice in any area. Think about what areas may grow due to the inevitable economic downturn. Some people are suggesting that bankruptcy lawyers, and yes, unfortunately, domestic relation lawyers may find themselves in a lot of business. But guess what? Right now, no calls, no court, no money. The impact on sole practitioners has been especially severe. They may be used to working alone, but many of them have a practice where that is really been seriously impacted by the COVID-19 crisis. Ethical dilemmas and COVID-19. Yeah, stress and anxiety, as we've seen, are already associated with lawyers and the practice of law. Add the stress and anxiety and fear of COVID-19, and we have new issues, ethical issues, to examine as well, because research shows there's a significant connection between anxiety and work, and that connection can have very important ramifications for us on many fronts. Job-related stress is likely to lead to negative coping behaviors. Negative coping behaviors. And at the core of addiction is negative coping behavior. That's what it is. Remember that earlier on I was talking about the progression of stress, stimulus, thought, emotion, behavior. Negative behavior is what we're trying to avoid. Anxiety has been shown to lead to worse outcomes in our work. It negatively impacts our creativity, our productivity. More importantly, it triggers feelings of self-threat, which may increase unethical behavior. Unethical behavior. This is what it looks like. This is the progression. Experienced anxiety resulting in perceived self-threat, defensive coping behaviors, then unethical acts. Negative coping behaviors are at the core of those unethical acts. So we've got to really, really, really look carefully. Anxious individuals are more willing to participate in unethical actions. That's what the studies have shown. There's a positive behavioral link with experienced threat and unethical behavior. Simply put, the link between experienced anxiety, either as a state or a anxiety trait, increases unethical behavior compared with people in a neutral state, non-anxiety state. Those who experience anxiety tend to behave unethically when the situation permits. When the situation permits. Threat and anxiety get people to experience a motivational shift and behave unethically. Ethical decision-making literature suggests that people who are more likely to behave unethically when that behavior benefits them somehow. The acquisition of resources, i.e. money, can overcome it when a person experiences anxiety from perceived threat. That's what they use to kind of make things better. Okay, anxious individuals are more willing to participate in unethical actions, doing things like falsifying their time records. We're now working alone or at home. Timesheets. Many lawyers have access to client funds, depending on their practice, and have direct access to their IALTA accounts, the lawyer's trust account. So now we're all working alone and at home. Distractions, less productive. We become less productive. That may, as a result, develop into the I've got to catch up or even get ahead for when things get quote-unquote really bad. So there's very, very practical problems. Gambling is online. I mentioned now this slide that I have says Pennsylvania because that's where I usually do these presentations. But there are approximately 20 states right now since the United States Supreme Court ruled in Murphy versus the NCAA, all forms of gambling are now available online. Yes, there's no sports going on right now, but there's plenty of other ways of gambling 24/7. And there has been a spike in the use of online gambling in the country since the pandemic. The last month, in some states, the revenues are equal to the previous 3 months combined. That tells you what people are. Some people are doing, and some of them are doing it because they are concerned about their finances, and maybe this is how I'll get ahead. And yes, anxiety increases the risk of developing alcohol and substance use disorders as well. So. Challenges to working from home, ethical challenges. You know, data protection has to be discussed with staff and your clients. You have to assure your clients that their data is safe, that confidentiality still exists, It doesn't matter if they're coming to your office and you're working from there, or you're at your kitchen table or sitting in on your living room sofa. It still has to be followed. Supervision is still a must. Most rules of professional conduct. Check the rules in your state. Check the rules in your state. I'm not going to say all because I haven't checked them all, but I know that most rules of professional conduct provide that lawyers must supervise subordinate attorneys and staff. And staff. Very, very important. First step, if you have employees working from home, is a conversation. Be clear about ethical and legal obligations or confidentiality during this COVID-19 crisis. Your obligations are their obligations. Create written policies and set out what your expectations are and what happens if they don't meet those expectations. Because the buck stops with the managing partner or you if you practice by yourself. Oh, and make sure that your clients are well informed as well. Discuss it with them. Keep them because they're going through plenty of themselves in their own areas of their lives and their businesses and their families. Just imagine if you have if you're a family lawyer and you have both spouses are still living in the same house and they're worried about data security. It really it's a far-reaching issue and we want you to make sure that you look at it. I don't have a whole lot of time to talk about the common warning signs at the law firm. These have always been common warning signs. I have this because you look at the top, isolation and avoiding interaction. Always been a common warning sign among lawyers. So I'm going to move through those a little bit quickly. Decreases in productivity, sleep complaints. Yes. Well, why? What is it about lawyers? Why are lawyers at high risk? Well, some people think that it's the practice of law, that it's lawyering, that we have now transitioned to a total win-lose game. And to the extent that positive emotions are part of a win-win game, when you shift to a win-lose game, there are going to be more negative emotions in the daily life of a lawyer. More feelings that everyone's relying on me. We're adversarial. We're taught to be aggressive, judgmental, intellectual, analytical, emotionally detached. Those types of feelings have predictable emotional consequences. The lawyer will be depressed, anxious, and angry a lot of the time. We tend to be thinkers, not feelers. The problem is that when lawyers have these feelings, we don't want to talk about them. We don't want to admit to them that we have a problem because it's a sign of weakness. We don't, we can't, we want to open our shirts and say, we're super people, super lawyer. But that's not what the case always is. That's what we want it to look like. You know, these may be great characteristics for a good lawyer, but as Benjamin Cardozo said, the qualities that make for a good lawyer may not be the same as those that make for a happy human being. So these additional burdens of responsibility that the COVID-19 crisis has placed upon us are making all of these feelings even more pronounced in our lives. But what keeps us from seeking or accepting the help we so desperately need? These are the four barriers: shame and embarrassment, denial, the fact that we're dealing with cunning, insidious diseases, mental health issues, substance use issues, alcohol issues. They're diseases. They're not just bad decisions, poor judgment. And last but not least, enabling. So how do we reduce the stigma? Well, we think that direct contact with someone who has personally experienced a relevant disorder helps. We have to reduce the stigma is caused by a fear and misunderstanding that surrounds what these disorders look like. Okay? We are The stigma that's attached to addiction and mental illness in our society as a whole is disproportionately magnified in our profession. Instead of admitting we have a problem and asking for help, we're overcome with shame and embarrassment at being labeled alcoholic, drug addict, depressed, much of which is caused by the misconceptions and stereotyping that surrounds these disorders. And then it's reinforced by the fear of how public disclosure may harm our reputations and careers, embarrass our colleagues in the bar, on the bench, or our families. But denial is the most potent barrier because it's a psychological defense mechanism, and people honestly believe they have their situation, their impairment under control. I'm not one of them. Everything's okay. So that is a very, very difficult defense mechanism to overcome, because the people who engage in denial truly believe that everything is all right. But the most difficult to deal with is what I call the conspiracy of silence. We call it enabling. When for motives good, bad, or mixed, colleagues protect the impaired individual from the consequences of his or her illness-based misconduct. The result is a progression of that illness to the greater detriment of career, family, and well-being. We must allow the pros of treatment to outweigh the cons. Enabling does just the opposite. It prevents people. It doesn't protect anyone. It prevents them from getting the treatment that they so desperately need. It fuels that denial. So I have a few questions here that you can look at and ask yourself whether or not you are enabler. If you know someone who may be impaired, and are you actually standing in the way of having them get some help? So what can you do? We know that your goal is to help motivate and assist people if you think that they have a problem or if you have a problem. That's you at the center of the ripple, picking up the phone. Use a lawyer's assistance program. We carry out a life-saving service. We provide caring peer assistance to save the lives and restore the health and professional competence of judges, lawyers, members of their families, and law students. I can't speak for all lawyers' assistance programs. I can tell you that here in Pennsylvania and in many other jurisdictions that I've been connected with, that they don't just offer assistance to lawyers, they offer them to their families. And they use a very liberal definition of that word, family. Anyone who connects themselves to a lawyer qualifies for free confidential services. Confidential services. Check the ethical rules in your state. For the most part, you may remain anonymous and still receive services. I don't personally know of any lawyer's assistance program that doesn't have that as a qualification. You may remain entirely anonymous. They do not disclose any identifying information. As a matter of fact, in most states, the Supreme Courts have granted an exception to the duty to report even misconduct, specifically in the rules of professional conduct. Check the rules in your state. Because most Supreme Courts recognize the fact that lawyers and judges may be reluctant to reach out for help when it involves issues of this type. And if they don't reach out, those problems will get worse. That's why the courts have granted an exception to the duty to report misconduct in nearly every state in the United States. Don't engage in this type of call or not the call. I'm okay. I can work it out for myself. I don't want anybody to know. I'm not really like those other people. I'm afraid I'll be reported to disciplinary boards. No, no, and no. Nobody tells anybody anything. Nobody reports anyone to discipline. Okay? And if you can't afford treatment, many states have programs that will assist a lawyer to find public or private funding sources. What will people say if you don't ask, if you ask for help? What are they going to say if you don't ask for help? These are progressive illnesses. They do not get better by themselves. And when they do get worse, what will people say then? And it is your business. If it's not you, but it's a colleague or someone you know who's suffering, it is your business. It's all of our business. It's all of our business. We're lawyers. Lawyers impact all aspects of society every single day of our lives. Just imagine the impact an impaired lawyer is having on society every single day. It's up to us as lawyers, to ask the questions that may change people's lives. And it's up to us as lawyers to pick up the phone and make the call that may save someone's life. Thank you so much for listening today. Goodbye.